We were in warm waters now and the ship cut through the waves, the engine thudding, the ship vibrating to the force, the winds hot and dry. Seabirds wheeled and circled overhead, following the ship, hoping for food. The occasional whale showed himself, a huge fish surfaced and leapt, only to disappear again under the waves, and there were shoals of smaller fish darting through the water like silver flashes. The moon hung in a clear blue-black sky, the sun rose over the horizon. Being away from land on the open sea offered a unique form of freedom, different from flying, better. It was entirely possible to get things in their correct perspective. As we departed the ports, the ship was taken out by one or two small but immensely powerful tugboats until we were safely away, the ropes could be cast off and we were free to get underway. Shen would settle down to dictation then. He was writing another book and I suspect he did some excellent work while on the water. It was planned that I would transcribe those tapes when we arrived at our destination, but alas, they were stolen along with his recording machine when we were in the port of Rio de Janeiro. We had been warned not to leave our staterooms open when in port, but someone had come in through the portal and removed his radio, as well as the tapes and recorder. What was doubly annoying was that now he felt time was wasted until we reached Uruguay when he would be able to get a further supply of tapes and another recording machine. On the positive side, he had an enforced rest, no mail reached us during those 3 weeks, and now he was prevented from writing, so there was no option but to resign himself to it. Finally, the day arrived when we sailed up the River Plate, that river which separates Uruguay from Argentina. One would have thought it logical to call at Montevideo first, but instead we went to Buenos Aires to unload cargo, the plan being to make a stop at Montevideo on the return journey for loading. For some reason we were held up in Buenos Aires for several days. It may have been because it was Christmas, or perhaps there was a docker's strike, I do not recall exactly what it was, but it happened. I can remember well, though, the frantic messages being received by the radio officer from our overwrought sponsor across the River Plate. Where were we? When would we arrive? Were we really there? The radio officer would come down from his minute cabin, where he spent his days trapped to his headphones, and hand us the messages, one after the other. It was alarming, and we were dreading some form of royal welcome when we did eventually disembark in Montevideo. We left Buenos Aires and, with a sense of foreboding, put ourselves in order for disembarking. However, it was not to be for a few more days. We anchored at some distance outside the harbor of Montevideo and lay there for 3 days and three nights in sight of our future home. Our sponsor and the most prominent members of the group, unable to delay a moment longer for the long-awaited meeting with he whom they saw as their guru, a concept which Chen disliked intensely and was to disaffirm, managed to get brought over to the ship in a liberty boat, one of those small boats used for transporting the crew back and forth between land and sea when a ship was forced to anchor outside the harbor. Rab and I stood on the deck waiting to greet them and take them to Chen in his stateroom, and I remember seeing them climb up the ladder one by one. Jaime, the leader and our correspondent, came first. The top of his head was balding, his shoulders were broad. I was expecting a middle-aged man both from the tone and content of his letters and from this first, almost aerial, view of him from the deck as he ascended the ladder, but as his face appeared I saw with astonishment that he was young. Probably no more than in his mid to late 20s. He had a small, neat black mustache and a round cherubic face. He was well dressed, but one assumed it was in honor of the occasion. He was assured, and shook hands with a slight bow, somehow reminiscent of an elderly European statesman, and spoke in excellent English, constantly clearing his throat. I found him intriguing from the first. Closely following Jaime came his wife, Angelica, a long-limbed, darkly exotic beauty. Her black hair was long and straight, loosely framing her lovely oval face with its lively brown eyes and glistening, smooth complexion. She had not a word of English, but her manner was altogether charming, the more so because she was seemingly unaware of her beauty and charm. It was utterly natural to her. The other two who comprised this first meeting were oddly mismatched, although it was later apparent that they had no connection with each other beyond their common interest in the group. Teresa was sophisticated and attractive in a much more worldly sense than Angelica. She was expensively dressed, but elegantly casual, her perfume was marvelously subtle and trailed in her wake compellingly. Her English was sketchy but perfectly comprehensible. It seemed, even at first glance, that she felt herself important for some reason, and it transpired that this was absolutely correct as she was the mistress of a wealthy man, important in the running of the country, who had largely financed this dream of hers, to have the llama teach her personally. Without her friend's input, in which she had persuaded him, it would not have been possible to bring Chen, and all of us, to Montevideo. The fourth member was a musician. His name was Jorge. He arrived on deck last, and with much ado, as though he had scarcely been able to make it, but he was laughing, full of fun and friendliness. Long, curly dark hair, skin tanned to a deep mahogany by the sun, and a plump, comfortable body, he was the kind of person one immediately felt it would be nice to be around. He, like Angelica, had no English at all, and as we got to know him better amused himself by teaching me utterly incorrect Spanish, sending everyone into stitches of laughter as I solemnly asked them to have pan negro while handing the white bread, assuring them they were mis enemigos as I smiled in a friendly way. If I had thought for a moment I would have known better, but at least it amused everyone and broke the ice. At this first meeting, the first meeting with the llama he so wished to impress, he was correct in manner, but was his own loose, untidy self, which was really a large part of his charm. These, then, were the first four. They crowded into the stateroom and greeted Chen with hushed reverence. It was hard for him to have four complete strangers at such close quarters, but only Rab and I were aware of how hard. No one would have had any idea that he was almost totally deafened, in fact under great strain. He partly relied on the two of us for comprehension, by which I mean that by watching our reactions and our understanding of the conversation he was more easily able to follow the gist of it. In this case lip reading was virtually useless as even Jaime's enunciation was uniquely his own and it took a little while for Chen to get accustomed to it. The four of them were avid readers of Chen's books, and had interest and understanding of esoterics, so it was obvious that they would sense his difference. And they were awed, they visibly felt the different and powerful vibration emanating from him, and one could see they realized they were in the presence of a higher entity. I found it fascinating because for the most part the people we had met in North America had been much more materialistic and generally lacking in spiritual perception, and it said something about the difference between the cultures, the one considering themselves the rich progressive leaders of the world, the other the dreamers, the ones aspiring to spiritual rather than material gains. I felt I was going to integrate easily and happily, and indeed I did. It was the start of a good period for me, although for Chen it was not entirely easy. This initial meeting, then, was relatively brief, under an hour, and by the time the four of them were drained emotionally, and Chen was exhausted mentally. Rab, seeing this, intervened and suggested they leave. Jaime took his leave graciously and with much ceremony, assuring us he would be there on the quay when the ship docked the following day, and would take us to the house they had rented for us just outside the city. It had been a good meeting, it boded well, and we went to our bunks that night feeling content, although perhaps a little sorry our sea voyage was over. When I look at the magic painting I see it coming together now, I see the story shaped, and I can see the end although, in truth, there never really is an end, just an eternal journey, the endless round of existence, on and on. Chapter 8. At the beginning of last week it was my birthday. It was one of those milestone birthdays, and people sent or brought me flowers. They seemed to know I like white, and our tiny house was filled with white flowers. Today, I rearranged the flowers, taking out and discarding the dead ones, roses, stocks, those small pom-pom daisies, and putting back the white and cream lilies in clean, fresh water. The perfume is heady and heavy and fills the house. I enjoyed the scent and the flowers because they were presents from friends, but when I think about it seriously, I know I shall be glad when the lilies, too, are gone and the house returns to normalcy. Yet 20, 15, or even 10 years ago I filled my house with flowers religiously every week. I went out to buy them. If there were no flowers, the place felt bare and unfriendly. It was somehow lacking. The point I am making is that it brings home to me how we change, and how we forget the way we were at different times of our lives until something happens to jolt the memory, and then things reach back to us out of oblivion, small things, the fine lines. I had forgotten how much I needed flowers. Is it the same with my story? Have I forgotten the fine lines after all these years? Is my magic painting too broad, too full of the big, bold strokes and lacking in the details? How can I tell? When the painting is finished and transcribed into words, things will perhaps come back to me that I had forgotten. But maybe, after all, the broad picture is the thing. Maybe it is the best I can do. I have in my mind the overall image of life in Montevideo as being quite charming. I have the sense of relaxation, warmth, color. I recall sitting on the crowded buses, squashed up tight in a corner with more people riding the bus than would ever be permitted on one vehicle by law. But whoever worried about the law in Montevideo? Hardly anyone. People were jumping on and off the buses, jostling each other, forgetting to pay their fare, laughing and chattering in a language foreign and quite unintelligible to me. I was an onlooker, an outsider. I was of their world, but at the same time not of it, remote but involved. I found it delightful, like being in some wonderland. I remember the European feel of the city without its being European, the beaches, the friendly and easy ways of the people, the musicians on the street, the tango music everywhere, in the bars, in the houses, the shops, that unique music and singing which is so typical to that area. I remember, too, the poverty, but somehow it was not so utterly miserable, hopeless and depraved as in North America. Even the beggars appeared more optimistic. It was just their way of life which they accepted. They saw no end to it, so they made the best of it. Perhaps, too, the belief in better things beyond this life permeated even the street life. The broad picture of life in Montevideo must have been rather different for Chen, and also for Ab. I was the one who went out and did the shopping, collected the mail, mixed with the ordinary people and enjoyed each day. They were treated almost like magicians in a traveling show, kept exclusive, remaining indoors, taking taxis whenever they went out. With hindsight, it must have been onerous for both of them, although things did improve as time went on. As good as his word, Jaime was the waiting for us when the ship docked and we walked down the gangplank for the last time. We were bundled into his car, an antiquated but well-maintained black Riley. Angelica was with him, so it was a tight fit, but we drove off in state and followed the course that he had obviously carefully mapped out as being the most scenic, the one with most landmarks. It was hot and it was Christmas, and I would rather have given the sights a miss and got a move on so we could reach the house and let QI out of her basket, but it was not to be. We crawled along, being shown all the points of interest, trying to show enthusiasm, but it was a trial of endurance. Sightseeing was honestly not my thing. The house they had chosen was beyond the city several miles, I would estimate 5 or 6, and was situated in a type of city seaside, not a resort because it was too close to the city, but a place where people went to sit on a not very pleasant beach, and paddle in not very pleasant water, by which I mean it was a grey, gritty sand, and an even greyer ocean. There were rows of houses, villa type, going up from the beach, and we must have been in the 6th or 7th row back. The group had no idea, naturally, of what would suit Chen, but they could hardly have made a worse choice, and it was not too long before we moved into the city to live in a modern block of flats overlooking the sea. Angelica turned out to be, as her name implied, quite an angel. We managed to communicate by signs, much laughter, and intuition. Whereas her husband was a pseudo-intellectual, and had no wish to deal with the tiresome business of daily living, Angelica was practical, tireless in her efforts to make us comfortable, see we had suitable food, and even made excellent lightweight black mandarin-type jackets for Chen, which he adopted as his form of dress for the rest of his life. Without her ministration and concern, we would have been in a sorry state. She had little or only superficial interest in the group. It was her husband's baby, and she did all she could to make it a success, not for love of matters esoteric, but for love and duty to her husband. She was a gem. Jaime was really an entrepreneur with a taste for the unusual. The only child of wealthy parents, he had never had to earn his living or do a day's hard work. He appeared to have unlimited funds supplied by his mother. In this and in other ways, he bore a vague resemblance to Proust. Even his appearance was similar, although he was fuller in the face and of a somewhat heavier build. He was, in fact, of French origin. He was a good and convincing writer and could spend hours agonizing over small things. One would constantly be left with the uncomfortable feeling that he had a hidden reason or answer to any query, something he did not wish to divulge. He was naturally secretive, less than straightforward, and could tie himself in knots quite easily. There was a markedly Peter Pan side to him, and from time to time it surfaced in the most astonishing manner, a high-pitched, inappropriate giggle, making silly faces behind people's backs, stupid things that were supposed to be funny, but were not. He was deeply and genuinely thoughtful, and searched unremittingly for the meaning of life. Above all, he was determined to make this venture a success, and never, ever to upset the central figure, Chen. Although Chen did not dislike him, he saw through him, and it was difficult sometimes to appear believing of him, knowing he was essentially evasive and misleading in an effort, as Jaime mistakenly saw it, to keep us happy. At the beginning, members of the group were brought to the house to meet Chen. There were perhaps 10 or 12 of them, and from the start they were made to understand that group meetings were not possible. Whether they were aware of Chen's hearing difficulty or not, I do not remember, but they arrived in twos or threes, generally later in the day. I was seldom present, although I was introduced to most of them. Rab would be there, Jaime and often Angelica, and they might stay for a couple of hours or under. The principal player, the one who had largely financed Jaime's scheme, only made himself known after several weeks. He was quite obviously not the least bit interested in Chen or his books at the beginning, his main purpose being to keep his mistress happy and occupied. He came to the house first brought by Teresa late one evening. I recall the visit well. Claudio was a smallish man, impeccable, slim and with an air of disquiet around him. Although his manner was cultured and pleasant, his eyes were hard and his mouth a thin line, a mouth which could well denote cruelty. "Please, my friend, Claudio, you meet him," said Teresa as she introduced him in her halting English. Chen was seated in a garden chair, white wicker, and he remained seated as Claudio took his hand with ceremony, bowing over it in a gesture of respect which was so exaggerated as to be obviously insincere. He was a man with an elevated opinion of himself, maybe justified, maybe not. His manners, though, were elaborate, and his command of the English language excellent. We all drank tea together, although I had the distinct feeling he would have preferred scotch, and made polite conversation. Then Chen suggested Rab and I withdraw. He would like to see Claudio and Teresa alone together. This was a departure from his usual procedure, and I have no idea what actually took place at that meeting. On this and all subsequent meetings alone with Claudio, Chen remained silent. But what did happen was that Claudio became like a lamb, like a convert almost, in that he seemed to rely on and believe in Chen totally, and was constantly turning up at the flat to seek his advice on this, that, or the other. Claudio was a leader in political affairs in the country, and the politics were complicated and devious. No one knew whose throat was going to be cut next, they just hoped it would not be theirs. Elimination by a bullet in the back of the head was not uncommon. Chen was essentially straightforward, and it must have been difficult for him to deal with Claudio's inborn deviousness and subterfuge. However, he did all he could for this man because he felt indebted to him, and the debt had to be paid back more than in full. Chen often explained that he had no karma on Earth, so if anything were not paid back now, the debt would fall to someone else in a later life. He never allowed a debt to accrue. It took nearly 2 years to get payment from the publishers in Buenos Aires. They were masters of procrastination. In the end, exasperated beyond belief, Chen threatened to write to the Argentinian president, a threat which he carried out, and when the police arrived at the publisher's office, they paid. They were too astonished to do anything else. Threats were customary, commonplace one might say, but as often as not were never carried out. It was a threat, no more. So when a threat actually was acted upon, it threw everyone involved into a state of panic. For us it was a helpful state and certainly a great relief to have the matter settled, to have what monies were owing, because now finally we were entirely independent. The Spanish editions published in Argentina were somewhat sensational in appearance. Large-sized paperbacks with bright covers and poor paper, they were nonetheless immensely popular. My Spanish is not fluent enough for me to be able to make a fair criticism of the translations. There was, however, a well-known firm in Spain, Destino, publishing different translations, and these books are beautifully produced. I have them still. There was never any problem with payments or any disagreement with the publisher in Spain, quite the contrary in fact. It must have been when we were in Montevideo that another film offer was made unrejected. There had been one earlier on for The Third Eye, but Chen was not interested, believing it would not convey the same message as his book, and I am sure he was right. Occasionally a film can be as good as a book, but not this kind of book done by that kind of filmmaker. What makes me sure the second offer occurred at that time was a conversation I remember having with Teresa, who had decided to make a friend of me and would invite me to lunch or tea from time to time. Her taste was flamboyant, but she had the means to execute it in the best possible way, and to visit her was almost to enter an extravagantly contrived theatrical set. Her ideas were somewhat weird, veering off from real life in all directions, and her interest in the occult, I am afraid, came under that heading. She was mainly interested because of her disinterest in reality, not necessarily from a desire to become more aware. But she was, despite that, a good companion if not taken too seriously, talkative and lively, cultured and sensitive to social graces, and one could depend on her always to be tactful and kind. This day I am remembering, the day we had the conversation about the film, was midsummer. Probably around the second Christmas we were there. Her flat was airy, it boasted large casement windows which, when opened wide, caused a refreshing breeze to gently flow through the place. I liked going there, being ensconced in one of her huge enveloping chairs or lounging on the claw-footed sofa with eagle heads for arms, stacked with elaborate cushions covered in vibrant purple, gold and crimson silks and damasks, ancient needlepoint, and remnants of fine old carpets. The black silk curtains were draped and hanging in place of doors, defining the different areas of the large, rambling space, and they trailed on the marbled floors, partially looped back with tasseled dark green silk cords. They billowed and moved gently as the breeze took them. It imparted a delusional but convincing feeling of coolness. We had just returned from a shopping spree, Teresa and I. She favored an establishment situated on one of the wide boulevards of the city, a smart area away from the busier business district, where she liked to pick up clothes and accessories imported from Europe, mostly from France and Italy. I had managed to sidestep her buying a gift for me with difficulty, because she liked to be generous, but there was no dissuading her from buying a cream-colored silk scarf for Chen. "You think he like?" she inquired, seating herself cross-legged on an oversized floor cushion. "Yes, I should think so. They give scarves in Tibet, you know, when they visit each other," I told her, as I idly wondered if she was truly comfortable sitting cross-legged or if it was a pose, something she had adopted for meditation because that was how it was done in the East where they sat like that routinely. As if sitting cross-legged on the floor was mandatory for meditation. Her maid entered noiselessly on bare feet, and placed a tray with tall glasses of iced tea on the low japanned table set between us. "Tell me, Amapola," about this film. The llama talk about it yesterday, but I don't ask more. It be done. Amapola was the nickname the translator had used in the books, feeling that the Spanish word for buttercup was ugly. No, he won't allow it, I replied. He doesn't like the fact that they want to suggest a homosexual relationship between him and his guide, the llama miniadond up. Dios mío, no, por supuesto, no. She was adamant in her disgust. These film people, que horrible, que feo, they are evil. How they think the llama be so wicked. Teresa was aghast. I was taken aback by her reaction. Teresa, it's not that he sees it as wicked, or sees the film people as evil, or anything like that. It's just that it wasn't so, it wasn't a homosexual thing, it was a loving and caring situation between teacher and student. That's all, that's what it was, that's why it was so beautiful and enduring, I told her. It would be misleading to put a wrong interpretation on it, it would make his story quite different, wouldn't it? She put her glass down on the tray while staring at me in disbelief. The llama, he have nothing against homosexuals. But the evil men, they do terrible things to small boys. Amapola, I do not believe you, you say it wrong. Well, you should talk to him about it, but until you do it's ridiculous to say they do terrible things to small boys. I told her, you are thinking of pedophiles. They are the ones who do terrible things, as you put it. But a pedophile, well, they can be heterosexual, bisexual or anything else, not just homosexual. Homosexuals are like everyone else except that they deviate sexually from what we consider as normal. But normal only means the majority, after all. I could see she was genuinely upset, but her attitude was widespread at that time. She remained silent and introspective. I had touched a sensitive nerve. She did, in fact, bring the subject up with Chen later, but her feeling around this may have had a lot to do with her gradual cooling, while Claudio became more and more trusting and believing, that and the fact that Chen did not quite fit the image of him that she had created in her mind. She had expected something like the cult groups of today. She was ready to sit at his feet and be taught Eastern postures in the hopes of gaining esoteric knowledge and awareness. She was not ready for self-reliance, and his straightforward, common-sense approach must have been a disillusionment to her. Coincidental with the payment of monies due from Buenos Aires, the club began to die a natural death. It was never something suited to Chen's way of life or his belief, and from the beginning he had said it would not be permanent. It was a necessary means to an end, and he fulfilled his part of the bargain in an exemplary manner. We remained in touch with the core members, but moved to a different apartment, much smaller and in the heart of the city, and while we were living there he completed another book. Now that the group was disbanded, he felt freer and managed to get out more during the time he was dictating the book. Writing can be a very intense activity, and the writer needs a change of scenery to regenerate. During the writing of the book he was able to fulfill that particular need. As always, I was transcribing his dictation. By this time we had worked together for a number of years, even so I never failed to be astonished at how he could dictate so evenly, clearly, and then at the end of the cassette he would stop perhaps in mid-sentence, only to start again the next day at the self-same spot. While in no way an expert on brain function, I have to say that his brain appeared to function on an entirely different level from normal. This was apparent all the time, and one came to take it for granted. But looking back, and now able to compare it with people around me at present, it was truly remarkable, not only his genius, but that fact that he was able to converse with simple people entirely on their level without ever confusing them or talking down to them. In fact, he seemed to prefer simple people, perhaps finding them more genuine. With the book and the club behind him, it was time to make plans to return to Canada. I was not happy. I had enjoyed Montevideo, and the thought of returning filled me with gloom and reluctance. In my heart I knew it was inevitable, all the same I put up considerable resistance. In the end, with great understanding of the situation, Chen suggested that if I did not settle down in Canada after a year, he would do what he could to facilitate my return to Montevideo. I am sure he meant it, but I am equally sure he knew it would not materialize. It did, though, achieve the end result of a peaceful departure from Montevideo.